Welcome to the Sunstone Podcast, everyone, where there's always more than one way to Mormon. I'm Stephen Carter, and I'll be introducing this episode. But first, I just finished sending a postcard off to press that's advertising the upcoming Salt Lake Summer Symposium. We'll be sending it out to our mailing list in the next few days, so you're going to find out if you're on it. And if you're not, never fear. I'll tell you about it right now. It's happening July 30th through August 1st at the Olpen Student Center on the University of Utah campus, and we have some great presenters coming. For example, you've probably read Eli McCann's humor columns in the Salt Lake Tribune. You remember, he's the guy who, like, grew up as Mormon as you can get in Utah. Then he married a man, settled in Salt Lake City with him, and spent the subsequent years trying to explain Mormonism to his husband. One of my favorite lines from him is, quote, "Here I am, finding myself having to explain to my husband, who has never been religious, why some people might be dense enough to think an apricot tree is covered in popcorn balls, or speculating about whether the pioneer children really did sing as they walked. And walked. And walked. I don't even realize what I'm doing. The music just pours out of me like I'm an inanimate jukebox and someone just shoved some tithing down my throat." Anyway, Signature recently published a collection of Eli's columns, and he's going to be entertaining us at the symposium. We'll also have Danny Stewart there. You may not have heard of him. He's kind of a local phenomenon, but he's a Utah folklorist who has documented more than 400 firsthand accounts of ghosts, monsters, UFOs, folk beliefs, and other strange experiences throughout the state. And whenever October comes around, he leads the Provo Ghost Tour around downtown Provo, where he brings you to locations that have been haunted by such terrifying beings as ghosts, clowns, giant flying manta rays, and Mormons. I've actually been on it twice. And those are just two of the fascinating presenters who are going to be there this year. You definitely want to be there. To buy your tickets, head over to sunstone.org/registration. And I look forward to seeing you there. But for the next half hour, we're going to take you into the back rooms of the Church Administration Building in Salt Lake City, where power plays abound. Today's episode comes from a session in last year's symposium by Matt Harris called "The Aging Crisis in Church Leadership: Hugh B. Brown's Response to Turmoil in the First Presidency." Harris is a professor of history at Colorado State University Pueblo, and he's the author of Second Class Saints, Black Mormons and the Struggle for Racial Equality from Oxford University Press. He's the president-elect of the John Whitmer Historical Association, and he's also very entertaining, as you're about to find out.
Hugh B. Brown was in the South Pacific on a church assignment with Apostle Thomas S. Monson when he received an urgent phone call from his daughter, Zina Lou, telling him to get home quickly. She informed him that President McKay had called two additional counselors, which shocked Brown. Neither Brown nor Eldon Tanner, the other counselor in the First Presidency, also Brown's nephew, they weren't notified beforehand. Thorpe Isaacson of the church's presiding bishopric and Joseph Fielding Smith, the president of the Quorum of the Twelve, were called to the First Presidency in late October 1965 while Brown was away. The news was so shocking and so unexpected that the Deseret News called it, quote, a surprise announcement. Surprise! We've multiplied you and didn't tell you why. Looking back, Brown should have seen it coming. In January of 1965, he and Tanner had a massive falling out with President McKay after he called Isaacson to chair an important building committee they felt they should lead or at least be consulted on. The president cut them out of the loop, leading to bad blood and hurt feelings. In addition, the counselors resented that Isaacson had been meeting all the time alone with the president. They feared that McKay was being manipulated by Isaacson, given McKay's frail health and the fact that he was 92. Their fears were justified. The prophet had been declining for a number of years. As early as 1961, Ernest Wilkinson observed that McKay shuffled as he walked, showing signs of cognitive impairment. In November 1963, he had a stroke, and in August of the following year, he was rushed to the hospital, where he was diagnosed with coronary thrombosis, a blood clot in his coronary artery. During this time, he was also confined to a wheelchair. The January meeting marked a point of no return between President McKay and his counselors. This is January of 1965. Things were said that could never be retracted. Isaacson is bringing you a lot of things about which he doesn't know very much about, Tanner bluntly told McKay. He comes and talks to you, tells you this and criticizes that and so on, and we do not know a word about it until decision is made. Tanner continued, you did not ask President Brown or me. You might have asked President Brown, but you did not ask me what I thought about the building committee. After listening patiently for several minutes, President McKay calmly replied, you are making quite a charge, to which Tanner snapped, I am, and I'm doing it intentionally. Brown also attended that fateful meeting, but allowed his nephew to speak for him. Brown was no dummy. You go ahead and get in trouble with the president. The prophet had never been spoken to in such a direct and forceful manner, and he was hurt. In March, McKay, still bristling over the January meeting, confided to his secretary, Claire Middlemiss, quote, when I think that I had to sit and listen to a counselor rebuke the president of the church because he valued the judgment of his secretary of 30 years and Bishop Isaacson, whom I trust, I cannot get over it, close quote. McKay further grumbled, quote, President Brown just sat and listened to him and never said a word, adding, President Tanner was his spokesman. I haven't used them much since. They can just sizzle. Not the language you hear in General Conference, is it? Brown's tongue-lashing of Isaacson didn't help the situation either. They had been cordial in the past, but now Brown had contempt for him. He accused Isaacson and Middlemiss of going behind his and Tanner's backs to reverse decisions they made. In Middlemiss's account, Brown became very abusive of Isaacson. During a particularly contentious meeting, after Brown spoke to Isaacson unrestrained, Apostle Grant Richards called Brown, quote, a sick man, end quote. Brown wasn't sick, but he was grieved, and rightfully so. President McKay consulted with Isaacson on important church matters that should have been Brown and Tanner's responsibility. What's more, the president was doing it behind their backs, seemingly impervious to how it might affect them. In August of 1965, as McKay was still seething over the January meeting, he confided to Middlemiss that he considered releasing Brown and Tanner from the first presidency. I do not use them much, he told her, and I do not take them into my confidence anymore. I have thought of releasing them. The prophet backed off, however, when he realized it would devastate them and potentially create a public relations scandal for the church. I have thought it best that I suffer it out and do the best I can, he told Middlemiss. I have you and others whose judgments I value more. Just think about that for a minute. He's telling his secretary, I value your judgment more than my two counselors. Who said this is a patriarchal church? Middlemiss immediately recognized the president's predicament and moved swiftly to fill in the void that McKay's loss of trust in his counselors had created. She masterminded Isaacson's call into the first presidency by encouraging the president to select him. Isaacson freely encouraged this. He showered Middlemiss with compliments and bought her a mink coat. He knew this influential woman was his ticket into the first presidency. His scheming paid off. Middlemiss, who was easily flattered, convinced the frail president that Brown and Tanner, quote, were not serving him well, close quote, and assured him that it was okay to add an additional counselor since Brigham Young had done it when he was the prophet. That's good logic, right? Brigham Young did it, so can you. Likewise, she assured McKay that Isaacson would make an excellent counselor because he was loyal to the president, had served diligently in the presiding bishopric, and had the temperament to put Brown and Tanner in his place, or in their place. Smith's call into the first presidency was no less shocking. President Smith and my father were not kindred spirits, Brown's son Manly reflected. Their personalities were so different. Brown was witty and self-deprecating, while Smith was dogmatic and serious. Moreover, Brown knew the old doctrinal warrior was approaching 90 and wasn't likely to contribute to the administrative work of the first presidency, given his lack of energy and cognitive decline. He too was simply too old and feeble, which Brown believed was part of a larger problem plaguing the church. The top quorums of the church were run by a gerontocracy, men whose advanced age and declining health prevented them from making decisions or dealing with problems, like Ezra Taft Benson, that required vigorous action. As Brown flew back to Salt Lake from the South Pacific in early 1965, he ruminated on what he was coming back to. Brown's official report didn't state why he left the church assignment early. It just said simply, it would be best if he returned to the United States. But the truth is, Brown was hopping mad. He had total disgust for what McKay had done. Those aren't my words, by the way. Those are Brown's words. He had total disgust for what McKay had done. And when he landed in Salt Lake, his first order of business was to confront the prophet. Immediately after Brown returned from the South Pacific, he read two explosive letters that were sitting on his desk at church headquarters. One was from his nephew, Clark Young, a well-respected medical doctor in Salt Lake, and the other was from Grant Lund, a longtime acquaintance of Brown's. Young, who had extensive business dealings with Thorpe Isaacson, told Brown that Isaacson was dishonest and immoral. He had consulted with Isaacson on medical claims when Isaacson worked in the insurance industry before he was called into the presiding bishopric, and said that Isaacson, quote, displayed an utter lack of conscience and principle, close quote. That was followed by another bombshell. Young had evidence that Isaacson was an adulterer. Lund's assessment was equally damning. He said Isaacson had committed insurance fraud. Brown took the complaints to the prophet and lashed out at McKay for calling new counselors without telling anyone. On November 24th, roughly a month after the new counselors were appointed, Brown told McKay, quote, someone is alienating you from your counselors, which was a cryptic reference to Thorpe Isaacson and Claire Middlemiss. Brown continued, you do not take us into your confidence and make decisions without us. Shocked at Brown's allegations, McKay asked what decisions he was referring to, and Brown replied, the choosing of two new counselors in the presidency for one. You were in Samoa, was McKay's quick response. But Tanner was here, Brown snapped. The tension between the two men prompted Brown to offer to resign from the first presidency. But the president wouldn't accept it. He was still needed, President McKay assured him. There's no evidence that Tanner offered to resign, but his biographer writes that he expected to be released for the strong position that he had taken against Thorpe Isaacson. McKay brushed aside Brown's concerns during the November 24th meeting and told him, quote, we should have harmony and that I have nothing but love for the brethren. But the president's wish for harmony wasn't possible. A defiant Brown refused to take a picture with the new first presidency. Thorpe Isaacson snarled that he wouldn't even consider it. The new year brought a whole new set of problems when Isaacson had a stroke that left him paralyzed and unable to speak for a period. He had only been in the first presidency for 3.5 months, and Harold Lee and Brown took Isaacson's stroke as a sign that God did not want him there. Why can't it be that he just ate too many cheeseburgers? We've got to impute, you know, God and everything. Lee said coolly, the Lord vetoed it. While Hugh Brown asserted, I love the passive voice, Hugh Brown asserted that Isaacson, quote, was stricken with a stroke, close quote. Meanwhile, Isaacson's stroke devastated President McKay, and he mourned the loss of his counselor. Furthermore, the prophet expressed regret over the brethren's opposition to Isaacson, and he sneered that no man either in or out of the church has ever talked to a president of the church as President Tanner talked to me a little while before I was appointed President Isaacson as my counselor. This is like 7 months later, and he's still bothered by this meeting they had earlier. The next day, Hugh Brown boarded a plane for Alaska. Brown's close friend and fishing partner, Jim Faust, who would later become an apostle and first presidency counselor, but his close friend Jim Faust, a stake president in Salt Lake and a fellow Democrat, arranged this fishing trip. In conjunction with President Orson Millett of the Anchorage, Alaska stake, the two men, along with other priesthood holders from Millett's stake, embarked on a fishing excursion to the beautiful Alaskan waters. It was a large party that required two passenger float planes to reach their destination. There is no place in the world like Alaska for fine fishing, Brown eagerly wrote in his diary. I believe I caught 8 or 9 fish. Do you want to know what he was doing while they were fishing? While they fished, Brown couldn't resist the urge to tell church secrets. You can just imagine this 88-year-old man, you know. You want to know what's going on in Salt Lake? Without considering the consequences or what was appropriate, he disclosed sensitive matters at church headquarters. Faust echoed him, quote, President McKay cannot make decisions and is not capable of running the church. Faust added bluntly, President Brown is really running the church. Brown added his own shocking confession, President Smith is incapable of running the church too, and that he ought to be bypassed over when McKay dies, and the appointment should go to Elder Harold Lee. Lots of bombshells fishing that day. The juicy gossip stunned the fishing party, the Alaska High Council, basically. And some in the group didn't appreciate Brown and Faust divulging church secrets. Jan Erickson, a former mission president, told a friend, May Dyer, the wife of General Authority Alvin Dyer, about what Brown and Faust had been saying. This prompted May to call Claire Middlemiss, her husband's cousin, and also President McKay's secretary, and complain that Brown was talking too much. Middlemiss wrote down the entire conversation in her diary. May is so upset to hear the things that President Brown is saying about President McKay and President Smith. President Brown is telling everybody that President McKay cannot run the church. Those are exact words. May Dyer's phone call to church headquarters was a triggering moment. Brown and Middlemiss never liked each other. In fact, they strongly despised each other. Brown couldn't stand Claire, according to Lola Timmons, one of McKay's secretaries. He resented her influence over McKay and found it infuriating when she would inject herself into the Brethren's affairs, especially when she orchestrated Isaacson's call into the First Presidency or prevented Brown and Tanner from seeing the president. Dad just walked right around Claire, Brown's son Manley recalled. As the Brethren knew, there had never been anybody like Claire Middlemiss at church headquarters. This is a secretary who had her own secretary. Certainly no secretary had ever played the outsized role that she played to a church president. She had worked for the president since 1935, never married, had few friends, and devoted her entire life and identity to serving the president. McKay trusted her implicitly, and the two became codependent as he aged, a fact Middlemiss proudly nurtured. She relished the power he gave her and wielded it over the Brethren like a cudgel, even the counselors who resented her high-handedness. That Middlemiss was a bircher and a confidant to Apostle Benson, Brown's nemesis, made Brown despise her all the more. Sometimes he was rude to her. Mostly he was just cold. On the one hand, Middlemiss must have relished tattling on him to President McKay for saying things he shouldn't have said in Alaska. According to McKay's biographer, Gregory Prince, she had deep animosity towards Brown related to her own political leanings. On the other hand, she knew that Brown telling people, these are my words, she knew that Brown telling people that he was running the church would only rattle the president and upset him further with his loose-lipped counselor. Also compounding matters, Isaacson wasn't getting any better, and the president seemed greatly worried over the affairs of the church. With Isaacson incapacitated, the prophet didn't have his trusted advisor to lean on, nor could he rely on Joseph Fielding Smith, who was too feeble himself. In early 1967, McKay contemplated adding a fifth counselor to the First Presidency. I cannot trust my counselors, McKay confided to Middlemiss. I cannot trust Presidents Brown and Tanner to do what I want done. He had his eye on Dyer, an assistant to the Quorum of the Twelve and Middlemiss's cousin. He didn't tell anyone at the time he was considering calling Dyer into the First Presidency. At the October 1967 General Conference, the president revealed his intention when he announced that Dyer would be ordained an apostle. Months earlier, Brown heard rumors about this possibility, but it caught him off guard when he learned about it in late September in a combined meeting of all the general authorities. It was a strange meeting, Marion Hanks called it, a most unusual experience. A few minutes into the meeting, the president muttered something barely coherent. It was a little hard to understand him since he had difficulty expressing his words, noted Apostle Spencer W. Kimball. The president then pulled out a note of it out of his suit pocket that Middlemiss had put there, and to the shock of all mumbled, Alvin R. Dyer is worthy of the apostleship. Alvin R. Dyer is worthy of the apostleship. Alvin R. Dyer is worthy of the apostleship. Three times he says that. The president implied that Dyer would be associated in some way with the First Presidency in the 12, but he didn't say how, nor did he elaborate on what duties he'd perform. McKay's impromptu announcement came out of nowhere and stunned the Brethren. I might add that there was not an opening in the Quorum of the 12. So this is just, you wonder why they're stunned, right? We were all shocked and surprised. It almost numbed, Apostle Kimball stated. Paul Dunn observed that Harold Lee, quote, about came out of his chair, close quote. And then Elder Kimball writes in his diary, that there was total silence after the announcement. After the brethren gathered their composure, they asked the president several questions. Would Dyer be ordained to the Quorum of the Twelve or just an apostle? What role, if any, would he play in the first presidency? How would his new calling be messaged to the church? McKay only answered one of their questions. He said he'd present the name of Alvin R. Dyer as one worthy to be ordained to the apostleship, but not to be a member of the Quorum of the Twelve. Talk about confusing. The prophet added, Dyer would be called upon to meet in the sacred meetings of the first presidency in the Twelve at all times and would be ordained a prophet, seer, and a revelator. None of the brethren were happy with McKay's announcement. Dyer had only been an assistant to the Quorum of the Twelve since 1958 and hadn't paid his dues. General Authority Paul Dunn accurately captured the problem, quote, you get an invitation to sit in the inner circle, and that creates resentment in the outer circle because of access to the prophet, close quote. Especially perturbed was Joseph Fielding Smith, who vowed to keep Dyer out of the Quorum of the Twelve meetings, except when they met with the first presidency. Marion Hanks witnessed firsthand the tension that Dyer's ordination had caused. When Dyer asked Smith how he was doing at the start of a meeting one day, the cranky apostle, quote, answered forthrightly and loudly, saying that if Al would leave him alone and stay away from him, he'd be doing a lot better, close quote. Dyer certainly didn't help his cause. Not only was he an upstart like Isaacson, but he was a determined soul, a bit too ambitious for the brethren's liking. Dyer was running errands behind Brown and Tanner's backs by going directly to the president alone without them, and the brethren didn't appreciate that any more than they did when Isaacson did it. Also, Dyer's ordination came out of nowhere. There wasn't an opening in the Quorum of the Twelve, and President McKay didn't provide a satisfactory answer when the brethren asked him why he was ordaining Dyer an apostle. McKay said he wanted Dyer to assist me in my official duties, but he never explained why Brown and Tanner couldn't do that. Under these trying circumstances, Dyer's ordination created a lot of suspicion, and Tanner reported that they'd have to wait and see President McKay's next moves. Brown wasn't as patient. He confronted Dyer, demanding to know what the president told him. Is it your understanding that you were a counselor in the first presidency? He asked sharply. After pausing for several seconds, Dyer told Brown he wasn't sure, but he suspected he'd be a counselor. Otherwise, why was he ordained an apostle? Brown saw right through Dyer's evasive answer and strongly suspected McKay intended to make him a counselor. Adding to Brown's suspicion, the president barely knew Dyer, so he immediately suspected Middlemiss's involvement. Middlemiss didn't even try to hide her excitement in getting her cousin ordained. After the big meeting when the prophet told the brother and he planned to ordain Dyer an apostle, Middlemiss ran out of the church office building excitedly and shouted to three general authorities as they walked on the sidewalk, did he do it? Do what, they asked. Did President McKay sustain Alvin an apostle? Yes, they replied. Oh, wonderful, Middlemiss sighed. I coaxed and coaxed him before that meeting. She's the one that put the note in his pocket to read. The backstory of how Middlemiss orchestrated her cousin's call into the high church leadership is both arresting, disturbing, and intriguing. It happened in January of 1967 when the president told Middlemiss he couldn't trust his counselors. Breaking from convention, he told her to read aloud the names of general authorities he might consider. As Middlemiss began reading, McKay sat back in his big leather chair, closed his eyes, and as she read Alvin Dyer's name, he raised his head up and opened his eyes and blurted, yes, that's the one. I like him. He's a man of good judgment and dependability. The president, now 93, was barely coherent, as the September meeting announcing Dyer's apostleship demonstrated. And it was quite clear, at least to Brown and the brethren, that Middlemiss took advantage of the prophet's dotage to get her cousin ordained. In a meeting with the counselors and the 12 on November 8th, while President McKay was out ill, Brown accused her of that very thing. Middlemiss denied the charge quite emphatically, but Brown brushed off her denial and asked her, why doesn't President McKay just release me? Brown was obviously raw and vulnerable, as his exchange with Middlemiss suggests, and he was now questioning if he belonged in the first presidency. With Dyer added to McKay's inner circle, Brown feared that he was becoming irrelevant. After Brown cooled off that night, he apologized to Middlemiss the next day for how he treated her. I was so upset and nervous. I want you to know that I have no ill feelings toward you, he told Middlemiss. Brown had all winter to speculate on what Dyer's role in leadership might be. His speculation finally ended when at the April 1968 General Conference, Dyer was called to be an additional counselor. A few days before the conference, the president told the brethren he intended to put Dyer in the first presidency. Although Brown had suspected this was the intention all along, he now had clarity. To make matters worse, the president asked Brown to conduct the session of General Conference when the church officers would be sustained, and Brown would have to feign support for Dyer as he read his name. When Brown called for sustaining vote, he defied the president's orders by sustaining Dyer, along with Smith and Isaacson, as counselors to the first presidency rather than as counselors in the first presidency. To most observers, this might appear to be a distinction without a difference. But to Brown, it wasn't. Leading up to the conference, the first presidency had heated discussions over this very issue. Tanner shared his uncle's feelings and wanted to use the word "to" when they message it to the church, which would imply that Isaacson, Smith, and Dyer were not official counselors, but merely consultants to the first presidency. Initially, President McKay agreed to this, but Dyer convinced him to change the verbiage, and the prophet acquiesced. McKay instructed Brown to use "in" when he announced the new counselors, but Brown flatly ignored him. Brown's disobedience and Tanner's support of his uncle proved too much for the prophet, and he fumed a Middlemas, "I made a mistake when I called those two men." Months later, he still stewed and said indignantly, "Those two men should not be where they are." There can be no mistaking that Dyer, Smith, and Isaacson's appointment to the first presidency was symptomatic of a much larger problem, which was McKay's fitness to lead the church. The once robust and decisive prophet brought much of the dysfunction on himself because he could no longer make decisions and refused to allow others to do so in his stead. To the brethren's frustration, he wanted to be consulted on everything at church headquarters, including even petty things like purchasing small turkeys for the church's charities. In addition, he insisted on having each counselor approve expenditures, no matter how small, and with the prophet out of the office much of the time due to illness, getting things done proved nearly impossible. What was happening to McKay was all too human and predictable. He refused to give up his car keys after a lifetime of driving, and when Brown and Tanner took over the wheel to run the church, he came to resent them. Unlike President Heber J. Grant, who let his counselors run the church when he was elderly and in diminished health, McKay was never able to do that, Hugh Brown's son Manley candidly admitted. McKay wasn't even well enough to deliver his own conference sermons. His son Robert had been reading them for him during the last 3 years of his life. In Brown's mind, the prophet's refusal to step aside and allow his counselors to run the church was a crisis that demanded attention, but a solution that did invite an easy answer. The revelations didn't say what to do when the prophet could no longer function, and founding prophet Joseph Smith never laid out a clear plan of succession. Into that void stepped Claire Middlemas and her cousin, Al Dyer. Brown told his grandson, Eddie, about the crisis. "Claire Middlemas and Al Dyer ran the church because the prophet was out to lunch," Eddie inarticulately noted. Brown put a finer spin on it. He said that she and Dyer were conspiring to run the church. This power vacuum created other issues too, particularly with Elder Benson, who continued to take advantage of the prophet's frail health. With the prophet unable to check him, he continued spreading John Birch conspiracy theories. In the spring of 1968, after riots broke out in 196 cities in 36 states over racial grievances, Benson told the Saints that communists had stoked them. Aggravating matters further, a white supremacist murdered Martin Luther King on the eve of General Conference, April 1968, and Benson circulated a scurrilous memo instructing the brethren not to memorialize him at the conference. And Brown, of course, ripped up the memo and acknowledged King's death. Also that fall, he didn't rip up the memo in conference, by the way. That would have been dramatic, right? What's he doing? But he ripped it up in private just before the conference. Also that fall, President McKay's diminished capacity could no longer be avoided, and Brown told Dyer that the brother needed to prepare for a contingency plan when McKay died. In October of 1969, President McKay lapsed into a coma, and over the next several weeks, the prophet would vacillate in and out of consciousness. With the end near, Brown pressed an unpopular position on the brethren. He told Dyer that Smith was next in line for the presidency and should be bypassed in favor of Harold Lee, a much younger man who was behind Smith in seniority. These are Brown's words. "President Smith could not possibly assume this position. He sleeps now through most of the meeting and is too old. The matter of the president and the Quorum of the Twelve becoming the president is, after all, simply a tradition and need not be followed. I think Brother Lee should come in and take the position as president when President McKay passes." Apostle Kimball agreed with Brown that Smith's age and health posed serious concerns, but even that knowledge didn't convince him to break tradition and appoint a younger man. Kimball was too much the traditionalist to even entertain the thought. In any event, Brown wasn't going rogue in trying to leapfrog over Smith. Heber J. Grant, a leader Brown deeply admired, said that church presidents shouldn't automatically devolve to the most senior apostle, and George Chucannon, an influential first presidency counselor, made the same point. Both believed that the 12 should choose a younger, more vigorous president, which was precisely Hugh Brown's point. Where did Lee stand? If he entertained the thought of bypassing Smith, he never said publicly. But as suspicions grew, Lee did his best to squash them. In the presence of Joseph Fielding Smith's wife, Jessie, Lee talked about presidential succession to Utah Governor Calvin Rampton, who was flummoxed by Lee's impromptu remarks since it didn't have anything to do with the purpose of their meeting. Under no circumstance would the brethren go anywhere except to the senior apostle for the president, Lee told Rampton. It took Rampton several minutes before he realized why Lee was talking to him about presidential succession. He was reassuring Jessie that he wasn't going to elbow her husband out of the way. McKay's dire condition and who would replace him became a heated topic at the First Presidency and 12's combined meeting on November 13th. Eldon Tanner started out the meeting by reading a letter from President McKay's physician, Dr. Alan McFarlane, affirming that the president was, quote, incompetent and wholly unable to attend his duties as the church president, close quote. The brethren then debated who would lead the church during McKay's incapacitated state. In Apostle Lee's judgment, section 107 of the Doctrine and Covenants said that the 12 should lead, while Brown and Tanner said that the revelations were vague, which they interpreted to mean that they should take the reins. Because neither could win the other over, they compromised. The counselors would invite Lee to their meetings, and they would lead the church together in consultation with the 12. The other sticky issue was bypassing Smith. Only Tanner supported Brown's position at the time, and as the first presidency minutes in Apostle Kimball's diary reveals, none of the brethren seemed cool to the idea at first. Kimball chalked up Brown's proposal to, quote, not being so schooled in church procedures, end quote, implying that he didn't understand the proper order of things in choosing the president. But Brown understood the proper order of things quite well. He just didn't agree with him. All of the backroom squabbling and backbiting reached a climax when President McKay died in January of 1970. What followed next was simply scandalous. Through a backroom deal, Harold Lee approached 93-year-old Joseph Fielding Smith and told President Smith that he would support him for the president if he'd make him the first counselor. In this arrangement, Smith would be merely a caretaker president, while Lee would be the de facto president. All decision-making would be Lee's. Part of the deal also included retaining Eldon Tanner in the first presidency, who was a genius at managing the church's finances. When Brown learned about what Harold Lee had done, a man he considered his close friend, he exploded in anger. Brown told his friend Marion Hanks all the tantalizing details, and Hanks wrote them down in his diary. President Brown called Lee self-appointed several times and expressed bitterness over Lee's behavior, close quote. What particularly stung is that Harold Lee, his lifelong friend, had betrayed him, and Smith allowed it to happen. When asked if he sustained President Smith as the new prophet, Brown angrily replied, "No comment. He is 93. He is worn out. He is done." Brown's demotion from the first presidency meant that he would now resume his place in the Quorum of the Twelve. There, while bitter, he made plans to address the dysfunction of having three old men run the church. He was particularly angry at Harold Lee for usurping his authority in the first presidency. Soon after Smith was ordained to the church president, the brethren began to whisper among themselves about Lee's strong-handed tactics. Apostle Mark Peterson, quote, spoke harshly of the first counselor and said that it was like dealing with the enemy all the time, close quote. Apostle Delbert Stapley, quote, noted that he had been relieved of every responsibility under the new order by Lee, close quote. Apostle Gordon Hinckley rued that, quote, Lee had relegated him as an errand boy with no authority, close quote. Even Apostle Richard L. Evans, a mild-mannered man, expressed his satisfaction, as did Ezra Taft Benson, who chafed when Lee tried to curtail his Birch Crusade. After Brown sat through a series of meetings with Lee in August of 1970, he staggered out of the temple, incredulous about what he had just witnessed. Brown saw his friend Marion Hanks in the basement corridor of the temple and told him all about the meetings. Quote, President Smith sat for 7 hours without saying a word, except upon a nudge from Harold Lee, Brown huffed. The only time Smith spoke, he said, is when Lee poked him to ask him for a sustaining vote. Hanks observed that Brown was very expressive and expressed bitterness over Lee's behavior. The church's public relations team gave the impression that Smith was running the church, but Brown knew otherwise. The Deseret News published photo ops that Smith did with the saints, and they'd run stories on the temples and ward meeting houses he'd occasionally dedicate. But he was just a figurehead, as Brown witnessed watching Smith sit idle through seven grueling hours of meetings without hardly saying a word. All of this disturbed Brown, and he made a radical proposal that would prevent elderly leaders like Smith from serving in the future. He proposed that all general authorities, including the 12 in the first presidency, be given emeritus status at the age of 70. His friends Paul Dunn and Marion Hanks made a similar proposal for the Quorum of the 70, and Brown adopted provisions from their proposal to apply to the 12 in the first presidency. Brown told his grandson Eddie that he felt confident the brethren would accept his proposal because he would be the first casualty of it. As the black sheep of the 12, Brown said, he felt sure that they wanted him out. Brown seems to have engaged in some wishful thinking. Although there was precedent for retiring sickly leaders like Apostle Charles C. Rich in the 1880s, none of the brethren had the appetite to retire themselves. Brown's proposal didn't entirely fall on deaf ears. In 1976, a year after he died, N. Eldon Tanner of the First Presidency announced in General Conference that each member of the Quorum of the 70 would be placed on emeritus status at the age of 70. Tanner said that ill health and a lack of stamina made the new policy change necessary, but he never explained why those same concerns didn't also apply to the Quorum of the 12 in the First Presidency. For Brown, though, it made perfect sense to retire everyone at the age of 70. It would avoid the dysfunction he had experienced in the First Presidency with Clara Middlemiss and her allies, Thorpe Isaacson and Al Dyer. It would allow for younger and more vigorous men to lead, and it would avoid questionable backroom deals by certain apostles yearning to be the president. Thank you.